Mars has been in the news quite a lot in recent weeks. NASA's Mars helicopter Ingenuity has flown its first mile on the red planet. China's new rover has travelled half a kilometre and sent back good pics. Scientists have concluded that the interior of Mars is quite strange, with a large light core and an unexpectedly warm crust. We keep looking for life on Mars, but we no longer search for signs of God in the heavens as humanity once did. Or maybe that's not right. An important team member on the Perseverance rover mission on Mars is an Anglican priest, Dr. Pamela Conrad. Pan, she calls herself for short. Pan Conrad is a NASA scientist working on the mission, but she's also in charge of an Episcopalian congregation and has her own church. She's an astrobiologist and mineralogist with the Planetary Environments Laboratory at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, and previously she worked on the Curiosity mission as well. Pan has two music degrees too and was once intending to become an opera singer. Dr. Pamela Conrad, hello to you.
Well, hello to you.
I was reading that what the Ingenuity mission is finding out in the Martian air is proving more important than hitherto thought, and that your Perseverance mission is kind of fusing with it more. So is that right? Does that include you? Do you get to fly around a bit on Mars now as well?
The mission and its ultimate goal is all about collecting samples, actually coring them from rock and from sediment, and caching them so that they can ultimately be returned to Earth. The helicopter is important because it can act as a scout. And though we can rely upon some of our cameras for long-distance imaging, we can't see over impediments. So where Ingenuity can go sometimes gives us a perspective that otherwise we wouldn't get at all and guide us to potentially interesting rocks to sample.
It's an exciting mission, and it's an exciting area of discovery, and you study what environments can sustain life. A couple of big questions early on. Did Mars ever really sustain life as we know it, as it were?
We'd all like to know, because we don't really understand our own origins. And because of the active resurfacing of the Earth, we don't have very much access to our deepest past, because the oldest rocks have all been subducted. So the beauty of going to Mars is because we can get a look at our deep past and maybe get a clue about what happened to initiate the start of life on Earth.
Yes, you're an interplanetary Sherlock Holmes looking for clues, and you are assisted by something called Watson, I think. What is Watson?
Watson is a high-resolution camera, a microscope, if you will, that is at the end of the very long and beefy arm on the rover. So we can not only get very close to rock surfaces and look at their fine textures, but we can also flip the wrist of the rover arm around and get a selfie of the rover, which is pretty spectacular.
So you can work out what the composition of the rock and the soil might be. Can you also identify microbes? Or, would you know a microbe when you looked at it?
We would know a microbe if we saw one, and that's because all life has chemical signatures associated with them, and so we would see that. The real question is, are we looking in the right places, and will we capture the right samples for return to Earth? Because it could prove frustrating to see any sort of microbe just sitting about on the surface because of the radiation environment. But upon coring a rock, going down a few centimeters, we might come up with something that is either a fossil or remnant microbe, or perhaps even microbes. Who knows? But to date, there is no evidence.
No, but it's a lottery, isn't it? You just hope you're looking in the right place, as you've just said.
It's a wonderful way to phrase it. It's a lottery.
I've got more to ask you about the science. But did you come to godliness late. I see you were ordained an Episcopalian minister only in 2017, Pam.
That's true. I always had an interest in the church, and I think that one of the reasons I have loved exploration is because the magnificence of all of the hospitable and inhospitable environments on the earth, the diversity of it, just really speaks to my soul. I think that as a child, the opportunities to explore are limited, but the craving is always there. So becoming a scientist is a good way to explore a lot of the planet. And in fact, I am so fortunate because I've seen a lot of the planet, actually spending some time in New Zealand on my way down to Antarctica. So the thought of being a priest is sort of a natural consequence of evolving from appreciation of creation to thinking about what are my responsibilities as a human being.
I heard you say in a talk that your faith in God and your faith in science are braided together like strands of a DNA molecule. I found that quite a fetching sort of description.
Yes, I think that you can't separate out the different parts of one's own self and the ability to look at empirical data and to look with the wisdom of one's heart provides a broad perspective that if one tries to separate out the two different ways of knowing, we end up maybe more shallow as people.
I understand from, I didn't know you'd passed through New Zealand on your way to Antarctica, but it's Antarctica I want to ask you about briefly. Because I understand from what I've read about you, and we may as well clear this aspect up of what you do, I understand there is scientific rigor and huge curiosity driving your work, not a kind of dreamy-eyed mysticism. But at the same time, you did once have a sort of, can we call it a mystical awakening on your trip down to the ice in Antarctica?
It's true. I consider one of the turning points in my life the first time I went to the ice, and I stood there at McMurdo Station, very near to Scott's hut, and looking out across the ice. It was a clear enough day that one could see the Antarctic mountain range, or the Royal Society mountain range, rather. And the wind was just howling past my ears. And I felt the entire character of my being shift from a sense of anxiety to a sense of absolute peace. And it was such an inexplicable experience. It was something that stayed with me, of course, until the next time I went to the ice to see if it could be duplicated. It was one of those once-in-a-lifetime moments.
So in Antarctica, you had an astronaut's sort of macrocosmic revelation, I think, that cast aside pettiness and saw the world as it could be. It was that kind of epiphany.
I think it's a very good way to describe that sort of epiphany, that it brings with it a reordering of priorities. I think it's different than being an astronaut in that I didn't get a view of what could be, but I got a view of the intransience of things, and that with comparison to eternity, the Earth is around for a little bit of time. And the idea that we might be wasting our time on pettiness was what so drove me to think about how I could do a better connection between creation all around us and the relationships between people.
Gee, the science and the altruism and the religion are all entwined with you. You aren't interested just in the geology of Mars either. What has happened on Earth fascinates you, and what happened when you managed to meet James Cameron, who made Avatar and Titanic?
One of the wonderful opportunities that I had from working in Southern California, where not only do we have the wonderful Jet Propulsion Laboratory, but we also have Hollywood, was being in the right place at the right time. And when Mr. Cameron was making the movie that was the proof of the pudding for Avatar. It was called Aliens of the Deep. It was to test out making 3D IMAX. He came to the lab and said, if you can make an instrument, we'll take you down there. We need scientists and instruments. And so we made a proposal to the laboratory, and they said, okay. And in 90 days, we built and tested an instrument that could withstand the high pressures at the bottom of the Pacific. And it was an amazing opportunity to see the robustness of life under conditions that would crush a human being. And it opened my eyes to not just how organisms survive extreme environments, but to understand viscerally that extreme is in the eyes of the beholder, and that the life down at the very bottom of the Pacific really is in its native habitat, and they would find our environment pretty extreme.
When you're down, you know, when you look way down and you're going to those thermal vents at the bottom of the ocean, could whatever happened to Mars happen to Earth? I know our magnetic field is stronger, we're more likely to hold on to our atmosphere, but seemingly Mars may have once been a going concern as a planet and now is not.
Scientists speculate all the time about whether or not Mars ever supported life. There was a window of opportunity between the time the planets were created and a rather violent time when planetesimals or protoplanets, bits of things that would later become planets, went flying through the area where the four rocky planets are, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. We call that time the late heavy bombardment, sometime between about 4.1 billion years and 3.9 billion years ago. And the thing is, if life got started early, before this time of bombardment, which caused a lot of havoc on these rocky planets, it could have started on Mars as well as Earth. So if we're trying to understand whether or not what happened to Mars could happen on Earth, I think we have a case of being in the right place or the wrong place and being sufficiently large enough to withstand the impact of these large asteroid impacts. And so it is correct to assume that we live in sort of the Goldilocks zone because we have a robust magnetic field that protects us from cosmic rays and also protects our atmosphere. Mars, when it was hit by these late heavy bombardment impactors, unfortunately lost its magnetic field, ended up with no way to protect itself against the agents of attack that we know as galactic cosmic rays and the energetic particles of the sun. And so, unfortunately, much of its atmosphere was ripped away. That's not likely to happen to Earth. But the lesson there in looking at Mars and looking at Earth has to be that you are what you are for a moment. Everything changes. And whether or not we as people or other species of life will continue to exist is truly a function of how adaptable we are to the changes. The other option is if we observe changes that make it very inhospitable for us to live on this planet, we either have to adapt or we have to stop doing the things that are changing it so that it's not optimal for human life.
We're speaking with Dr. Pamela Conrad, a NASA scientist working on the Perseverance mission. I'll get back to Mars because what you do is so interesting. But are you regarded as a curiosity of sorts, either among your NASA colleagues or among your parishioners at St. Albans Church?
I think I am regarded as a curiosity of sorts, or we wouldn't be speaking.
True.
But that just tells me that we need to do better about integrating the different parts of ourselves as humans. And the fact that it's a curiosity makes me a little bit sad because there is so much we can offer as humans if we're willing to dig deep and use all the parts of ourselves. So, yes, it is right to characterize me as a curiosity. I hope that that will change.
You know, C.S. Lewis, that great Christian apologist, he was interested in Mars. He got the terrain of Mars all wrong when he wrote his science fiction trilogy. But for him, which you probably know, but for him, the symbolism and the mythical qualities of Mars were the thing. But at the same time, he wanted to get rid of the phrase outer space and refer to the high heavens instead. In other words, he wanted God to be out there. But 2,000 years ago, Pan, when the Christian era began, a lot of people were far more literal. I mean, heaven may well have been above the clouds. So does the certainty of the Bible still stand up to scrutiny?
I think we make a mistake if we try to turn the Bible into an historical or scientific document. The Bible is a good representation of our faith history, and one reason why we consider it a living document, or as we vow when we're ordained, it contains all the tools necessary for salvation, is because the Bible is an endless well of inspiration for theological reflection. That being said, what we know about the cosmos and cosmogenesis, that is the creation of all the materials therein, is very different now.
The Bible, one more question on this aspect. The Bible said that God separated the light from the dark, but we now know the light is one of trillions and the heavens are infinite and, you know, not doing much for us on an everyday basis. I suppose my question is not whether science is compatible with religion, because of course it can be. And it was an English clergyman who predicted black holes in the 18th century. But whether we have moved past the founding document of Christianity, in a sense, whether we need a revised version, I suppose, is a way of putting it. That, because in the old days, Jesus, as far as I know, never addressed the full amplitude of what's up above us. And that has proved to be fairly amazing in ways that they never knew.
I think what is so interesting to me about not only the Bible, but also about the evolution of our spiritual heritage, and I do mean the evolution of our heritage to where we are now, is that we keep learning new things that are not necessarily incompatible. It's when we miscast the Bible as a document of literal historical significance, or as a document of scientific explanation, that we get into trouble. The great medieval rabbi, Rashi, spoke about Genesis in such a way as to say, it is ridiculous that we could consider this an historical document. It loses its holiness if we degrade it to the level of a paper that can be amended. Yes. The perspective that one has as a person of faith and as a person of science is to take all the input of knowledge that we can get, put it all together, and see what new understanding emerges, because it's a system. And systems have emergent properties, and that is what makes them alive. So if I think about how all of the chemical elements were made during the Big Bang, and then I think about the fact that everything that exists is made out of that same stuff, and out of that limited set, that specific and limited set of chemical elements, we get this amount of diversity. That's a miracle. And so I call it the Big Bang, or we could also describe it when God was creating the heavens and the earth was without form. You don't have form and structure unless you have matter. So we can call the formation of the universe whatever we want, but if God created it, everything exists in God. That is not incompatible with a view of cosmology or even the concept of multiverses.
Yeah, well, I won't get into quantum theory with you, but it's interesting you say that, and interesting that you say, and many others agree, that the heavens can, speaking of Genesis, can still declare the glory of God, and the sky above Proclaimer's handiwork. But do you think as a species, though, Pan, we'll find more bandwidth for our religious beliefs? Because that must happen, surely, as the science improves, as the discoveries, quantum or not, come at us. You know, we will start thinking differently about creation, will we not?
I hope we do. I hope we do think differently about creation. Because if creation is the one-time event that made the building blocks that gets everything going, then we have a very different view about how we get such diversity and the concept of being alive or being static. And so if we wish to speak of faith as a living process of transformation, we see this living process of transformation everywhere within the observable universe. Those have to be compatible, and it proves that you have to have evolution, because evolution happens because things move, and as they move, they form relationships with other things, and as they form relationships with other things, their inherent properties change as a function of that. We know this from the predictive tools of quantum physics.
I'm not going to ask you about whether we should be spending vast sums on space exploration, because it's a 50-year-old question and we never would have taken that money and spent it on poverty and disease, human nature being what it is, I suppose. But I will ask you what it will lead to, though. All the money that NASA and the billionaires and whoever else is trying to reach space, all the money will lead to, because you must have thought about this.
I do think about what the money that we spend on exploration returns to us in value. And it's an appropriate question to ask. And here's what I think about that in two parts. First of all, everybody's talking about the billionaires at the moment. And it doesn't matter as much that they are billionaires as much as it matters that we step back and take a perspective like this. All organisms explore. It is a built-in, hardwired biological process. And the reason organisms do this is to understand opportunities and threats. We are exploring because we are hardwired to do that. And the question of how we get there and who spends the money on it in part determines how badly we explore and how badly we harm other living things in the pursuit of this. With respect to whether or not governments should spend money on things like space exploration relative to spending money on the development of vaccines or the eradication of poverty or the cleaning of the environment from pollution or the preventing of global warming, the answer to all of it is yes, we have to do it all. And the trick is to do it in such a way that we have a diverse portfolio of human advancement so that we can be better humans. If we don't do this, we just won't be anymore. We will either outlive our usefulness and not be able to adapt to the changing environment, or we will. So how much money gets spent on it is sort of, you know, that's a question of resource allocation, right?
Will the billionaires conquer space in the end? Will they be the ones that reach Mars first or float a colony in the clouds above Venus? Because venture and vanity always go together, probably.
Venture and vanity do always go together. And the history of humankind as colonialist creatures tells that story. However, it's not just the humans. All life is colonial. And so the question is, can we, because we are human, make the choice not to be colonial when we explore? And that is, to me, the most interesting of the questions. I'd much rather the billionaires were using their private money as enterprise to develop the latest technologies to get us to wherever the limits of our exploration take us, than the governments. But understand that it will happen regardless of whether governments do it or private individuals do it or companies do it. It will happen because it is the destiny of all biology.
Here's a question I asked Brian Cox once, and I managed to buttonhole our most famous doubter, I suppose, in New Zealand, a non-theist who's esteemed here, Sir Lloyd Gehring, once, theologist, and I asked him if he could say in 25 words or less why he thinks there is no God. And he said, because I see no order in the universe. Do you see order?
What a wonderful question that is. So I'm going to give you two answers to it. I see order in the universe, but as a person who has studied crystallography and the structure of minerals, I think it's fascinating and kind of gives me a chill when I realize that the highest order symmetry is when you're completely disordered, when you have a sphere. So think about that. Think about the philosophical implications of order and disorder and what gives you the highest symmetry.
So I'm inferring from that that you can see order if you want and see order and see no order if you want, to be honest, even though you can elegantly make arguments for both.
Humans excel at pattern recognition, but sometimes we're a little arrogant about it and we pick out what we think is the pattern and we're wrong. So the beauty of trying to come up with a proof or a disproof for the existence of God is that the best person to do that is a scientist, because the really good scientists are supposed to have such open minds that we're willing to entertain new models when our previous models were wrong. So we have to leave open a lot of possibilities.
We all know that scientists aren't really like that deep down, though, and there's a lot of confirmation bias, not hopefully at the experimental level, but scientists are human beings, aren't they?
Absolutely true, but we can aspire.
How do you test for how habitable a planet may be?
It's really hard because of Earth-centric bias to imagine how habitable a planet would be for, say, indigenous life. And that's one reason why we are so focused on microbes, because they're very cosmopolitan and they tolerate a wider range of conditions than, say, humans or puppies. So we look at the potential requirements for microbial life. Is there an energy source? How widely do the temperature ranges fluctuate, and how frequently do they fluctuate? What is the radiation environment like? Is there something that will serve as good as a heat sink as water does? Is there something that's as good of a solvent as water is? Are the chemical elements that we tend to find associated with life present? And are they present with their companions in sufficient abundance that we could make life? Questions like that. There are all sorts of physics attributes and chemical attributes, and so we can inventory them.
And eventually, although you've found sign and possible probable cause for the loss of the Martian atmosphere, sign of bombardment on Mars, you will eventually work out what sort of history a planet like that has had. And you will know at some point how it lost its atmosphere, and you will be able to eventually explore all of what are now hypotheses, do you reckon, and reach conclusions?
I think it's correct that we will ultimately come up with a really good model for the history of Mars. We see evidence of evolution of the Martian surface that looks very like evidence of similar processes on Earth. So we can tell a little bit of the history, but it's when we bring back these samples from Mars and we can actually date different rocks that will enable us to date different processes that have affected Mars, and then we'll have a much better model of its history.
And when will that be, do you think?
Now, don't quote me on this as an exact truth, because I have to look this up, but I thought it was sometime around 2024 was the Mars, the mission that would bring back the samples that the Perseverance mission is actually going to core and cache on Mars.
In a sense, space is more ordinary. Not space, but Mars. Let's stay with Mars. It's more ordinary than we think, as well as being that marvellous red thing up in the sky. I mean, planets are made of the same stuff, aren't they? I mean, Mars looks like a barren place on Earth to us, to lay people. And I know space and time add immense complexity to what you do, but it's all both kind of strange and familiar, isn't it?
It is absolutely accurate to say Mars is both strange and familiar. And when we get new images down each day and we look at them, I have two big monitors on my desk. I might as well be looking out the window at a harsh desert landscape on Earth. Oh, look, there's crossbedding. Oh, look, there's something that looks like a texture. Could it be an igneous rock? Is it a sedimentary rock? It does look familiar, but yet it's not Earth. And so we have to remember the things that make Mars unique may fool us as we try to make a model about what we think we're seeing.
Yeah, that's interesting. Do you think, though, that we will find an environment out there on some rocky planet, a decent sort of distance from a decent-sized sun, that will support intelligent life? Do you think that's inevitable, however strange and mysterious that life may be?
I think there is probably other life in our universe. Whether or not we will find it is probably a matter of how much we have the will to continue to look.
Interesting, isn't it? It remains a possibility, though, that it's just us, doesn't it? That our destiny is to colonize the universe, and we may meet microbes, but we won't meet Martians. I mean, that is the other possibility, that in your parlance, is God's plan.
It is absolutely possible that we are the first life, and that if we go elsewhere, that we will be the site of the next life. We just don't know.
What's more important to you? I know you don't have to choose between them, but what's more important to you if you had to choose, being a priest or being a NASA scientist?
Well, I think you know the answer to this question. My full-time job is as the rector of a parish. Mm. That being said, a part of myself is a scientist and will always be. The most central part of my being is that I am an amalgam of many things. So as an explorer, a musician, a scientist, I can use all of those features of my being to be one whole integrated person who is committed to being a shepherd.
Yeah, you have a pretty impressive range of skills. I looked at your church online and found a photo, and on the sign outside, I don't know how current it is, but on the sign outside, it read, "He is risen indeed, hallelujah." So where will you go, do you think, when you die? I mean, we all become stardust, I suppose, but there is a hereafter for you, do you think, somewhere out there?
So I tend to think not so much about a hereafter as a here eternity. And I believe that we are living in a universe that resides within God. So no matter where we go, there's nowhere we can go where we're not part of that system. I believe that when people refer to what we call God's kingdom, what we're really referring to is what could be here. And so I'm interested much more in how we treat one another and what we can do while we're here than what happens when we die.
Yes, I understand, but it's the big question that people want to know individually. Will we keep going in your cosmology?
Well, we do keep going. There was only one set of chemical elements made at the moment each one appeared in the Big Bang, and everything else is resurrection and recombination. Will my soul keep going? Yes, I believe that. Will my thoughts keep going? That's a big mystery. I don't know. Will I be sitting on a cloud playing a harp? I don't think so.
With the ambient temperature at 25 degrees. I know. Hey, lovely to talk to you. Fascinating work that you do. So you're getting close I wouldn't say close in terms, I don't mean close in terms of tomorrow, but in a sense, you're getting close to finding out the mysteries of Mars now, aren't you?
We're getting closer all the time. Each mission that we do to explore Mars is based upon the foundation of a previous mission. And every time we learn something new, we figure out different ways to ask questions, and we'll just keep getting better and better.
Would you like to go there yourself? I know that you also floated in your mind the idea of becoming an astronaut once. So would you actually, I know practically you probably won't, but would you like to go out there?
I think that I'm much more in love with the planet Earth than the planet Mars at this point. I think it would be fun for a joyride, but as a one-way trip, no. I'm having a great time here, and I'm not ready to leave it yet.
That's a fair comment. Very good of you to give us your time, and thank you so much.
My great pleasure. Love to all the friends in New Zealand.
Pan Conrad.